What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Larry Goldsmith, author of the new novel, Bashert. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've been seeing lots of articles lately about the failure of American Jewish communal leadership. While there seems to be rather general agreement on the fact that the major institutions and organizations of American Jewish life are flopping and have been doing so for years, there isn't a lot of agreement on just why that is, or perhaps even what exactly is wrong. At least at one level, the data seems clear. While the total number of American Jews has remained consistent and even grown a bit over the last 10 years, the involvement level of those Jews and their commitment to active Jewish life has declined sharply. This is consistent with the trend away from religious observance and belief in nearly all developed countries, including Europe, and it is also consistent with a significant decline in American religious observance and commitment, including church membership, over the last decade. For Jews, this has emerged in a declining level of synagogue membership and attendance, particularly true in the evaporating conservative movement, and in the aging of attendees and declining membership of many Reform congregations. Our own congregation, Beit Simcha, here in Tucson, is something of an anomaly. We have grown each of our 5 years of existence, including through the worst of the pandemic. But we are just one congregation, and the vast majority of non-Orthodox synagogues have been shrinking for 10 to 15 years. Jewish community centers in many parts of the United States have also suffered a serious decline. In Southern California, where some 600,000 Jews live, the JCC movement actually collapsed, although our JCC here in Tucson is quite vibrant, albeit with a caveat. Over half the membership is not Jewish. I don't mean that there are both Jewish and non-Jewish people in the household memberships at the JCC, but that no one is Jewish at all in over half the members' homes. Jewish federations, some now call themselves philanthropies, not federations, although the national movement remains federations, have seen a flattening and then declining number of donors nationally. Their leadership is trending much older, and the actual amount generated in donations has also declined sharply in recent years. The rabbinical seminaries that were the flagship educational institutions of American Jewish movements, well, they've also gone through some serious challenges, with the conservative movement selling off its beautiful West Coast campus in Bel Air in Los Angeles, and the Reform movement ending ordination at its historical seminary campus in Cincinnati. A variety of less academic and less stringent ordaining institutions have sprung up. Nowadays, you can't really tell if someone who calls themselves a rabbi was ordained by what used to be called a correspondence course, or through a significant academic institution of Jewish learning. Only among ultra-Orthodox congregations and institutions is growth apparent, particularly the cult-like Chabad Hasidim. And while Chabad Lubavitch is everywhere, and they tend to give birth to a lot of children, its growth does not generally provide much in the way of support for other institutions of American Jewish life, preferring to support only Chabad-oriented schools and organizations. American Jewish organizations and institutions have been actively seeking solutions to this declining commitment and involvement for some time now. at least for 45 years or so that I can speak to from personal experience as a Jewish professional, a cantor, and a rabbi, and as the Two Jewish Radio Show host these last 20 years. Those efforts have ranged from serious attempts to do outreach to the unconnected and really change the way we do things, to many cosmetic rearrangements of the proverbial deck chairs on the Jewish Titanic that don't have any real impact unless it's to move us closer to those icebergs. So, what has gone so wrong in these legacy Jewish institutions? It very much depends on who you listen to. Some believe that an overwhelming focus on pro-Israel support has blotted out the greater values of Jewish observance through prayer, study, mitzvot, and ethics. If all you care about is supporting Israel and fighting those who oppose its policies, well then, Jewish holidays, Shabbat, synagogue life, and other vital ways to express Judaism and true community cease to matter. If pro-Israel support is the only form of Jewish life you are living, and that satisfies your dedication to the Jewish state, you don't really need to do anything else Jewish, right? Other articles and books believe that the focus on social justice and progressive values has undermined the Jewishness of synagogues and other Jewish institutions and organizations deeply. If LGBTQ plus issues are central to your values, or rallying support for climate change is the principal way you express your dedication to Tikkun Olam, you need not do it by attending services, praying, or studying Jewish texts, or even by making certain that your children and grandchildren or the children and grandchildren in your community are Jewish or learning Judaism. And there are plenty of Jewish and, of course, non-Jewish organizations that serve these causes without requiring other forms of Judaic commitment or involvement. Another key criticism is that large Jewish organizations, federations and philanthropies prominent among them, of course, have spent a whole lot of time and money building themselves fancy buildings and increasing their executives' pay and titles and adding employees, and have siloed themselves away from actually funding Jewish organizations that support Jewish prayer, study, and practice, such as synagogues and religious schools. By creating insular, clannish cultures focused on fundraising for their own usage, they were successful in creating circles of money and activity that focused not on deepening or enriching Jewish life, but on creating cliques of donors who spent a great deal of time and energy congratulating each other on their own virtues. That didn't add to the pool of connected and committed Jews at all, of course. Still others point to intermarriage rates, now perhaps 65-70% of all weddings that Jews are involved in here in America, as the reason that Jewish institutional life is in such apparent decline. Or maybe it's the high cost of belonging to Jewish organizations, synagogues, JCCs, day schools, summer camps, religious and Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah preparations, kosher food, etc., etc. Well, that price can be a serious barrier to involvement. I guess I have a different take on these concerns. I believe that by far the most important, vital, integral institution in Jewish life is the synagogue. It has been the one element of Jewish life that has survived and persevered since antiquity. For well over 2,000 years, it's kept Jews Jewish, involved, and principled throughout all that time. All the other Jewish organizations, causes, and institutions, however valuable, could disappear at once. And so long as synagogues continued to exist, so would Judaism and Jewish life. But if all the other organizations, causes, and institutions remained, and only synagogues disappeared, Judaism would also disappear, at least here in the diaspora, in one generation. Everybody, it seems, has wanted to replace the shul as the way that Jews could be Jewish for the last 50 years, and has done everything they could to push things that way. The results are evident, and they are not good. If you want to fix American Judaism, support your local synagogue. Attend it. Work to make it better and warmer and more inclusive. That's where the energy and funds need to go. That would make a difference. In other news, it's June now, which means the season of summer camp for kids is close. To play us in this morning on Too Jewish, here's the late, great Alan Sherman's classic, Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, an annual tradition on Too Jewish.
Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining, and they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining. I went hiking with Joe Spivey. He developed poison ivy. You remember Leonard Skinner? He got ptomaine poisoning last night after dinner. All the counselors hate the waiters, and the lake has alligators. And the head coach wants no sissies, so he reads to us from something called Ulysses. Now I don't want this should scare you, but my bunkmate has malaria. You remember Jeffrey Hardy? They're about to organize a searching party. Take me home, oh Mudda Fada, take me home. I hate Granada, don't leave me out in the forest where I might get eaten by a bear. Take me home, I promise I will not make noise or mess the house with other boys. Oh, please don't make me stay. I've been here one whole day. Dearest Fada, darling Mudda, how's my precious little brother? Let me come home if you miss me. I would even let Aunt Bertha hug and kiss me. Wait a minute, it stopped hailing. Guys are swimming, guys are sailing, playing baseball, gee, that's better. Mudda Fada, kindly disregard this letter.
That was Alan Sherman's Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, in time to send your kids off to summer camp. Our guest on Too Jewish this morning is a forensic accountant and attorney, but he has written a fascinating novel about ultra-Orthodoxy and the Soviet Jewry movement, and it incorporates both of his previous careers in a way. Find out how when you meet Larry Goldsmith, as he joins us in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Larry Goldsmith is a financial forensic sleuth, which is not why he's here on Too Jewish. He's a licensed attorney, a CPA. The only thing you're missing to be a perfect Jew, of course, is a medical doctor degree. But he is a financial detective, and that has led him to pursue writing fiction. His new book is called Beshert. And it's a great read and a very interesting story. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
I'm well. So really, this whole story revolves around the persecution of the Soviet Jews and the attempt to free them from that persecution. Tell us what led you to write Beshert.
Two things. One, I was listening to the radio, and I heard some music from Woodstock, and I was starting to think about what was going on in that day. And I thought to myself, The story of the Jews getting out of Russia is a piece of Jewish history that's not told. You know, there's a million Jews in Israel today and another million or so in the United States, in Europe, that would have never been allowed out of Russia had not been for people standing up to the Russian government.
I think you're right. I think it's a very undertold story. It's funny because when I was growing up, it was a huge thing. You know, Pepsi sells to Russia. Russia sells Jews. You know, there were all these sort of efforts on behalf of the prisoners of conscience and Natan Sharansky. And so, but still, I think that the younger people today don't know anything about it.
Exactly. You know, you and I probably were, you saw the sign Free Soviet Jews on every synagogue. During the Cold War, it was Scoop Jackson who tried to tie trade with Russia to freeing Jews.
Right. I remember well. In developing this story, you know, I guess your ultimate hero is a rabbi. So, of course, I think that's a great idea. Tell us how you developed it.
I wanted to have it, obviously, a Jewish character to tell the story of freeing the Jews from the Soviet Union. But to me, many people, Jews and non-Jews alike, do not understand the kind of life that religious people lead. They think it's a cloistered, they think it's, they don't understand that these can be very loving, giving people. So here I have this great rabbi who looks like Santa Claus with his stomach, getting down on his knees and playing with his grandchildren on Shabbos. It's not an idea that most people would think of.
The stereotype of religious Jews is that they're very insular, but they were critical. The Haredim, I don't even think we really called them Haredim much back then, in the work to free Soviet Jews. You have a contrast, right, between the secular protagonist and his involvement in this religious community. Was there anything personal in that decision?
You know, I had fallen in love with, and she wouldn't marry me, a very religious girl. And I thought she was the most perfect person in the world, and she's Shira in my story.
I wondered about that. We will talk much more with Larry Goldsmith. His book is Beshert. It's a terrific story about really the freeing of Soviet Jews and the U.S. government when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Sign up for religious school for school-aged children or grandchildren. Join us for our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events open to everyone. Come in person Friday night, 6:30 p.m. services, followed by Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. with our services at 10 a.m. to follow with Torah reading and Kiddush to follow after that. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom, and all of our services are live or on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson.
Our wonderful religious school will be available in blended format too, some students live, some on Zoom, starting in August. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting fifth year. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, Jewish Radio 18 at gmail.com, or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean, and available on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review 2 Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So there have been a lot of interesting Jewish-themed and Israeli, of course, television series that have come across recently. Transatlantic is one that you've been watching. Tell us about it, would you?
Happily. I binge-watched it. I thought it was terrific, and I really couldn't stop watching it once I started. It's only one season. It's, I don't know, 6 or 7 episodes. And it's based loosely on two real people. One is named Varian Fry, who was the senior representative of something called the American Emergency Rescue Committee in Marseille during the early years of World War II. So like the end of 1939, and the series only goes through like 1940 or 41. And his partner in, not really in crime, but partner in Pikuach Nefesh and saving lives, his partner was a guy named Hiram Bingham, who is, to us U.S. diplomats, a legendary figure because he defied his boss. His boss was the consul general in Marseille, and he was basically a fascist, a Nazi sympathizer, a virulent anti-Semite, but also racist, homophobic, whatever. I mean,
every bad thing you could think of.
Everything you would associate with. And his boss refused to issue any visas to the U.S. for Jews who were fleeing the Nazis, as the Nazis were taking over gradually all of Europe. Hiram Bingham, on the other hand, was a junior officer, like the vice consul or something, and he would sneak into the office literally under cover of darkness when the consulate was closed, and working like with a flashlight, basically, issue visas and save these two guys between them saved many hundreds of Jews. The American Emergency Rescue Committee had actually a list of European artists, intellectuals, writers, painters, philosophers who were Jewish and who they wanted to get out of Europe and into America. So for a long time, one of the few ways you could get out of Europe was through Marseille, and then they basically closed the port. So people had to sneak over the Pyrenees into Spain and then ultimately to Lisbon and go from Lisbon to the U.S. But there was still a workaround, which a lot of people whose descendants I know, I mean, one is a good friend in L.A. They went from France to Martinique or some French colony in the Caribbean or whatever. And from there, they went to Cuba or Mexico or both. And then ultimately to the U.S. Sometimes they didn't make it to the U.S. until 25 years later. Right. I mean, it was like a whole generation of stories of going first to somewhere in the Caribbean, then to Mexico, and then finally to the U.S.
It's a fascinating story, and I'm interested in the whole mechanics of how these diplomats, Marion Frye, Hiram Bingham, how these guys managed to pull all this off.
Varian wasn't a diplomat. Varian worked for an NGO called the American Emergency Rescue Committee.
Right.
And he was... I mean, he was in France on an American tourist visa, basically.
Huh.
His status was of questionable legality. And as the Nazis exerted more and more influence over the French government, even the status of American diplomats was not so clearly safe. So eventually, all diplomats left. And it's funny, too, because that consulate in Marseille has long been problematic. It's a small post, so there's often just like a main guy and a subordinate. And if they don't get along, it can cause problems for everybody else.
Very interesting. Transatlantic. People should watch it.
Yep.
Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. At Shabbos services, Morris goes to his friend Irving and says, "I need a favor. I'm sleeping with the rabbi's wife. Can you keep him in shul for an hour after services for me?" Irving is not happy about the idea, but being Morris's lifelong friend, reluctantly he agrees. So after services, he strikes up a conversation with the rabbi, asking him all sorts of stupid questions just to keep him occupied. After a while, the rabbi becomes suspicious and asks, "Irving, what are you really up to?" Irving, filled with feelings of guilt and remorse, confesses to the rabbi, "I'm sorry, Rabbi. My friend is sleeping with your wife right now,
so he asked me to keep you occupied. The rabbi smiles, puts a brotherly hand on Irving's shoulder and says, "You better hurry home, Irving. My wife died 2 years ago." Yeah, that's kind of awful. That was the Old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature of Two Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion, Baha'olotcha, from the Book of Numbers, is filled with incidents and events from the wilderness days, as well as a couple of important commandments. It is in Baha'olotcha, this week's portion, that instructions are given to create the first menorah, the seven-branched candelabrum, that became the most enduring symbol of Judaism. It's also here that we get the first rumblings of rebellion that will explode into full-fledged revolt against Moses and Aaron in just a few more weeks in the disastrous story of Korach. But most important in this week's portion is a peculiar little story about gossip. Moses has married a new wife, and his brother and sister, Aaron and Miriam, don't think much of her. They begin to talk about her and about Moses behind his back, circulating rumors and gossip. She isn't the right ethnicity. They don't like her influence on Moses. She probably laughs inappropriately or wears her hair too long. The response by God is swift and decisive. Miriam, although oddly not Aaron, comes down with a dread ailment. Moses' siblings realize the error of their gossiping ways, and they repent and are healed. But the point is made. Gossip and slander are among the most destructive influences in all of society. If we don't avoid them, we will indeed have tsoros, trouble and heartache. If we can avoid them, we have every chance to build a society of holiness, honesty, and good. It's a great message. As the Talmud teaches, gossip murders three people: the speaker, the listener, and the subject. It hurts the person who gossips, the one who listens to the gossip, and the person who is gossiped about. All are morally damaged by the experience, and no one benefits. Circulating rumors, sharing personal information about others, accurate or not, is not the way we create genuine community or intimacy. Lashon hara, the unethical use of speech, is attractive, but it is wrong and destructive. There are many other things we can speak about, all of them more valuable. A famous dictum says that great minds speak about ideas, smaller minds speak about events, and the smallest minds speak about others. May we learn from our portion that the best way to use speech is to build, to heal, to learn, and not to engage in gossip. When we come back in a moment, our guest this morning, Larry Goldsmith, author of the gripping new novel Beshert, explains how he became interested in the Soviet Jewry movement in the first place and his own personal experience of Orthodoxy. Find out when we return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Sackler family, Jewish billionaires whose marketing of the painkiller drug OxyContin fueled the U.S.'s ongoing opioid epidemic, will receive full immunity from all civil legal claims in exchange for spending up to $6 billion on addiction treatment and prevention programs. The decision to grant immunity by a federal appeals court panel last week ends the thousands of civil lawsuits that have been filed against Purdue Pharma, the Sackler's company, over opioid deaths. It clears the way for the company to declare bankruptcy, a move considered essential to a plan to pay out billions of dollars to help states and communities address the opioid crisis. Of the up to $6 billion allocated under the deal, about $750 million will go to people who became addicted to OxyContin and to family members of people who died from overdoses. The ruling reverses a lower court's 2021 ruling that bankruptcy proceedings were an improper tool for shielding wealthy private citizens from legal repercussions. It does not grant members of the Sackler family immunity against possible future criminal charges. Purdue Pharma founders Arthur Mortimer and Raymond Sackler were the sons of Jewish immigrants in Brooklyn who went to medical school in Scotland because U.S. schools wouldn't admit Jews in that day. Mortimer and Raymond introduced OxyContin in 1996 after Arthur left the company. The family then made billions by aggressively marketing the drug for more than 20 years, even amid signs it was driving users into opiate addiction. The three brothers have all died since, but other members of the family have retained control of Purdue Pharma. Their wealth is estimated at about $11 billion. The Sackler name was a regular presence in philanthropic circles until the opioid lawsuits began building up in 2019, at which point many cultural institutions began refusing the family's donations and removing their name from buildings. Jewish artist and activist Nan Golden spearheaded a grassroots movement opposing the family for years. A notable beneficiary of the Sacklers, however, Tel Aviv University, has resisted pressure to drop the Sackler name from its medical school, though its school quietly removed the Sackler name from marketing materials last year. Another major beneficiary, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, has retained the seven galleries donated by the Sackler family, including the wing containing the iconic Egyptian Temple of Dendur. But the Met removed the Sackler name from the galleries. The Victoria and Albert Museum removed Sackler's name a couple of years ago from its galleries, but Harvard University Art Museum still has the Sackler name on it. That's because it's named for Arthur Sackler, who was not involved in the company by the time OxyContin was developed and marketed. The murder and hate crime trial of the Pittsburgh Tree of Life synagogue murderer began last week. The October 2018 attack slaughtered 11 Jews praying in that conservative temple Shabbat morning, first murder of Jews praying in a synagogue recorded in all of American history. The murderer was a white supremacist named Bowers who believed, and likely still believes, in the conspiracy theory that Jews are working to assist non-whites in replacing whites in America. The Tree of Life Synagogue, which serves as a combined home for four conservative and a Reconstructionist congregation, they have all shrunk in size over the course of the last decade or two, as nearly all conservative congregations have. They now share space. Anyway, it was one of many that partnered with HIAS, the Jewish Refugee Organization, on immigration Shabbat that year. My own congregations have always partnered with HIAS as well on refugee Shabbat, and we've had their CEO and other high-ranking representatives on Too Jewish several times. That apparently provoked Bowers to go in and murder. The defendant is accused of murdering 11 people, wounding six at the three congregations that met in the same building. He faces 63 charges, 22 of which are death penalty charges related specifically to allegations he targeted Jews. 11 counts of obstruction and free exercise of religious belief resulting in death. 11 counts of hate crimes resulting in death. Prosecutors previously rejected a guilty plea so that they could pursue the death penalty. Punishment, families of victims, and congregational leaders in Pittsburgh have debated. In her opening statement, Bowers' lead defense attorney, Judy Clark, said the defense would not contest the events or Bowers' responsibility. Clark is known as the attorney for the damned for her determination to keep her clients from execution. She has defended the Unabomber, the Boston Marathon bomber, and one of the conspirators who planned 9/11. This senseless act, the loss and devastation, were caused by Robert Bowers, his attorney said. There is no disagreement, there is no dispute, there will be no doubt as to who shot the 11 congregants. On October 27, 2018, Robert Bowers, the man seated at that table, loaded with ammunition and firearms, entered the synagogue. Clark said her defense would focus on whether the defendant's motives met the standards required by the government's charges, particularly regarding the 22 death penalty charges. We can at least do our best to uphold the rule of law by figuring out
what were Bauer's motives and intent, she said. She argued that her client's statements, which focused on his deluded belief that Jews are intent on replacing white people, do not make clear that this intent met the standards enshrined in federal law. My only question as this trial grinds on is why it has taken 4.5 years to try a monster like Bauer's for the mass murder of innocents, a murder that everybody agrees he committed. Is this truly what the American justice system looks like today? I know it's a cause celeb trial. I know there was a pandemic, but I'm afraid a trial that takes 4.5 years to even begin cannot be called efficient or speedy justice. And we would be remiss here on Too Jewish if we failed to note that for all of our legitimate and serious concern about the growth of left-wing anti-Semitism in America, it is Bauer's and the monster who killed a woman in the Poway San Diego synagogue, both on the extreme right of the political spectrum, who have actually murdered American Jews at prayer. Joining a chorus of American Jewish organizations, the U.S. government and various media organizations, an umbrella association of American Orthodox rabbis is calling on the Russian government to release Evan Gershkovich, the imprisoned Jewish reporter for the Wall Street Journal. The Rabbinical Alliance of America said last week that Russia should do immediate justice by releasing Evan Gershkovich. The alliance, known as the Iguda Rabbanim, represents more than 950 Orthodox rabbis. Gershkovich, 31 years old, is the son of Jewish refugees from the Soviet Union. He was arrested 2 months ago and charged with espionage, an accusation that Gershkovich, the Wall Street Journal, and the U.S. government categorically deny. Last week, his pretrial detention was extended until the end of August. He faces a sentence of up to 20 years in a penal colony. As Americans, we condemn how our fellow citizen, Evan Gershkovich, has been unlawfully arrested and detained by Russian officials, said the group's executive vice president. As Jews, we are offended by the apparent resurgence of governmental Russian anti-Semitism. As rabbis, we protest this injustice and demand Russia does the just, moral thing and immediately frees Evan Gershkovich so he can safely return to his family. Jews in America and around the world have taken action to support Gershkovich since his arrest, reviving practices that recall the movement to free Soviet Jewry during the Cold War. In May, the Jewish Federations of North America held a rally calling for his freedom. And that's the news of Jews around the world. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Larry Goldsmith is a trained attorney and CPA and a forensic sleuth, a financial forensic sleuth, who's written a book, Beshert. there is a financial tracing aspect to this story about the liberation of the Jews of the now former Soviet Union, but then, of course, the Soviet Union. It's really hard to make, you would think it would be hard to make that interesting, but it's really interesting. Tell us a little bit about how accurate this is to real life.
Which part?
Well, I mean, there's financial contributions, there's political contributions, there's an accusation of bribery and so on. Does this stuff go on?
All the time. And dirty prosecutors I see in court all the time, too. I testify in court, and sometimes I'll see the attorneys come in and just lie to the judge. They'll hide evidence from the other side. It's terrible.
That doesn't restore my sense of American justice. In this story, the Nixon administration, which one must admit is an easy target, is interested in shutting down the operations to try to free Soviet Jews, and that political pressure in order to further, I don't know, what would you call it back then? Is it just free trade? Is it glasnost? And, well, it's before glasnost and perestroika.
There was a Stark Treaty. So one of the highlights of the Nixon administration was he was able to develop a nuclear war treaty with the Soviet Union, limiting the amount of nuclear weapons. However, they also, as part of a side deal, wanted to give the Soviets free trade, make them a favored nation. They didn't have to pay any types of tariffs to the United States, or their goods wouldn't have to be charged tariffs. And there, some brave senators and congressmen said, hey, you're not going to, we don't want this. We want the Soviet Union to allow the Jews and anyone who seeks religious freedom to be able to have exit visas. Because prior to this, and some of the stories in my book are real, of Soviet Jews who were thrown into prison camps because they asked to leave. They lost their jobs. They were kicked out of the universities. They were beaten, all because they wanted to leave the Soviet Union to have religious freedom.
What was your involvement in the Soviet Jewry movement?
As a student, I was part of the student struggle for Soviet Jewry. I attended protests. I did all I could to enlighten the people around me, my peers, of the dilemma that was happening in the Soviet Union.
I recall my parents going on a secret mission to bring Hebrew books and other materials, I think taluses and stuff, sewn into their clothing when it was illegal to do any of that stuff, meeting with refuseniks in the Soviet Union. They were not spies. They were, my dad was a cantor, my mom was a teacher. They picked kind of normal Jewish people who were active and cared about and had been involved in the Soviet Jewry movement, but weren't famous, right, to do that kind of work. The stuff that you focus on in this book was sort of at a higher level, I guess I would say, the rabbis, the Rebbe's involvement in all that. How did you research it? What did you base it on?
One of my friends was a refusenik. He was thrown in a jail, and his story is in the book, where his uncle was one of the top generals of the Soviet Union, and he was an embarrassment. So here he was in jail, and his uncle comes to visit him and says, you're going to stay in jail, and you're going to be beaten every day unless you give up this idea of getting out of Russia. And he said, no, I want freedom. And the uncle finally said, okay, you're getting out of the country tomorrow. You have to divorce your wife and children, and we're never going to allow you to see them again. And he joined all kinds of U.S. economic missions to Russia in order to try to see his wife and kids. And he would never get past Sweden or Finland, where you had to get the visa to get in. They never let him in.
Tell us a little bit. You have a law degree and became a CPA. Which one came first?
CPA.
And then you went on to get a law degree. Were you already doing forensic accounting?
Not really. I got my law degree 10 years after I was a CPA. And then I had my own CPA firm for a number of years, and I started doing forensic accounting.
You know, obviously you integrated into the book, but tell me a little bit about calling the book Beshert.
Beshert, as you know, means two things. It means fate, and it means soulmate. So Michael and Shira are the soulmates, but it's the fate that Michael's a criminal attorney and defends her father when no one else would to save his life, because otherwise he would die in prison.
Nobody likes the Nixon administration. Well, I guess there might be one or two people. Roger Stone comes to mind. But do you know, did they actively prosecute any Refusnik supporters, anybody who worked in the Soviet Jewry movement in this way?
They actively worked against free trade, knowing that there was a tie-in the legislation regarding the free trade, because there was a tie-in that the Soviet Union had to release Jews, otherwise the United States government would not allow free trade.
And because of that, so this is maybe a little more extreme than what actually happened, but certainly they were not in favor of like the Jackson, was it Jackson-Varnik Amendment? Was that what it was called?
Oh, you're very well informed, yes. Yeah.
I'm quite sure that the administration was not in favor of that.
They actively fought against it.
You know, they were not above underhanded means, as we all know. Was that part of what led you into this kind of plot device? I don't want to give away too much. I'm trying to be careful here.
Yes, exactly. I felt that they would do anything possible they could to destroy the movement of the individuals who wanted to stop the Soviet Union and to pressure the Soviet Union into releasing people or allowing them to have freedom of religion.
Larry, what's next after Beshert? Are you going to continue to write?
Definitely. I just had published Payback, which is a totally different story. It's a story of a woman who's kidnapped because of, quote, the alleged sins of her father, and she's to pay back for what he did. And she's a nice Jewish lady, 20 years old, who's in college. It takes a lot of twists and turns.
Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about your books?
LarryGoldsmithAuthor.com.
Larry, I want to thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Beshert. Where can people go to get it? I assume Amazon, of course. Where else?
You could buy it from LarryGoldsmithAuthor.com. You press a button and you'll go right to Amazon.
Thank you so much. All the best.
Thank you, Rabbi. Be well.
You too. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Rabbi David Kasher, the new West Coast director of Hadar. Interesting guy. Fun interview. And please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night for services at Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. Shabbat services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and available on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes from Israel. It's Elad's new release, Tipat Gan Eden, A Drop of the Garden of Eden. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace. אני חוזר מהמסע סופר דקות שאת סופרת אני מת לראות אותך תדעי לך שהתגעגעתי
רואה תמונות שלך כל יום לשבת על קפה בבית זה נראה לי כמו חלום כבר קל
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.